Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our podcast on evaluation of both public policy and public programs. This is Jenny joining you yet again for one of our last episodes. This is actually going to wrap up our material for this course. So today's episode won't be tremendously long. We've only got two chapters to talk through, and it's really about data analysis and interpretation. And then finally, how do you close out an evaluation project? Because at the end of the day, as an evaluator, you generally aren't directly involved in a program in a way where you stick around, at least not in an evaluator stance or format. I've known several evaluators who've gone on to become maybe more involved in the work that puts them more in the program staff role, rather than an outside or even an internal evaluator. But for the most part, we're going to approach it as, let's pretend we're external evaluators, and what do we do now? As we've done so many times before, let's please navigate to the weekly roadmap page for this class so that we can open up our slides, very succinctly named chapters 11 and 12 slides. And you'll see from the title, once you get those cracked open, we're talking about analysis and interpretation and information sharing. So our objectives in this episode, again, highlighting the main points from those final chapters. And I do want to emphasize, these are chapters that don't correlate quite as well to our assignments and projects, because what we're looking at with these chapters is more of what you would do after you've done a lot of data gathering in the evaluation process. And recall, we are just coming up with a plan in this course. We're not actually delving into fully doing the research and gathering data. We're putting the roadmap out there, so to speak, for how we would do that on whatever program or policy you've selected. Once we've talked through those highlights, I'm going to give just a few notes from the perspective of someone who's done evaluation for a while. And then I want to touch on some points about the evaluation project, the final one, and our final exam. So let's dig right in, or jump right in, or however you tend to approach that phrase. Let's get to it. We've worked through coming up with an evaluation plan. We've gone from the history of evaluation to thinking about the ethics considerations and the concerns, that lovely research history that sets us up to think about all the terrible things that have been done, and then of course the way we're going to avoid those. And then we get into things like program narrative, describing what a program is, what its goals are, how it works. Then we pushed into building logic models. So what are the theories or explanations of how the program or the policy is going to take us from the goal that they have to the outcomes that they want to see? And then as we move into this last portion of the class, we're fully putting, you know, flesh on the bones of the evaluation plan. And that evaluation plan, or the evaluation matrix, if you're looking at the templates, is saying, okay, let's take what's listed in our logic model for the outputs sections and the outcome sections, and let's ask evaluation questions like we drew from chapter 7. Let's do some research. And, you know, we have different options for research. We can go quantitative or qualitative in terms of the things that we're measuring or gathering. We can do that through surveys or interviews, or maybe we're looking at reports. Chapters 8 and 9 kind of walk us through this. And then we get to chapter 10, where we're thinking about doing our actual data analysis. And this all assumes that we kind of followed this step-by-step process. It presents evaluation in a way where we gather it all up and we kind of write it like an academic research paper, where we wait for the very end to look at our data. But really, that's not how evaluation tends to work in the real world. Yes, that is the standard approach for impact or summative evaluations, because those programs or policies have come to an end, or the time frame that we want to look at has come to an end. But in a lot of scenarios, you really shouldn't wait until the end if your evaluation is not completely summative. I'm putting this note on slide 4 to say don't wait to look at the data. Don't wait to use the data, because a big piece of most evaluation conversations is people approaching you as an evaluator and saying, okay, what's going well? What isn't going well? And what maybe do we need to be on the lookout for? They might not be inviting you to make changes to the program. They might be seeing you truly as an external evaluator who is supposed to be totally hands-off. Thinking all the way back to those calibrators that come up with respect to, let's say, evaluator role or responsibility, right? But for the most part, most programs are going to be asking you, as soon as you start gathering data, what's going on? And it's good for you to tap into that, to be aware of how things look, and it can prove to build some really great trust in a relationship if you can start passing along early information and giving those insights to program or policy staff. Again, this doesn't have to be you saying they need to make changes, but when you can answer questions on the fly and maybe even do update meetings with the program staff, you know, more regularly than once a quarter, or maybe once a quarter is good enough. You know, it's not great to check in only once a year. I've done that for a number of programs where I was an evaluator, and to be honest, those evaluation reports were, I think, mostly checking the box, so to speak. They had a grant, they needed a report, I would provide the report and give my recommendations, and things didn't always change. Or more likely, things rarely changed, because there just wasn't an ongoing conversation about what the evaluation was showing. Great idea to do check-in meetings, to make people aware of what's going on, and to keep an eye on what you're seeing as data trends over time. It doesn't have to be mind-blowing. It doesn't have to be earth-shattering insights. It can be as simple as, hey, we're finding that the people you said you were going to work with aren't really showing up to these meetings. So maybe we just need to come up with a strategy for getting more people to attend. And that simple kind of feedback is often really very helpful for program staff. At this point, I'm going to make a bit of a personal plea to all of you. When you go out and do any form of evaluation, I mean, I'm talking truly in your lives, personally, in your work professionally, maybe in work as an evaluator, make sure that nobody jumps over the what did the program do question. Because more often than not, we tend to make these assumptions that once we've created something, well, it did what we said it did. And so very often, that is not true. Or at least it's not true from the sense that maybe what was proposed wasn't done in the way that it was proposed. So slide 5 is me saying, you need to place focus on what was actually done and how implementation of the policy or the program worked. And that's a big part of the final evaluation matrix for your program. Go back to that outputs list. If they're listed on your logic model, we need to ask questions about, did they actually happen? Because if they didn't, how can we get to the outcomes? We have this lovely little scene, picture, whatever, snippet on slide 5 with the phrase, then a miracle occurs. And that is what I would call the black box of implementation, where we tend to just assume these things happen. Yeah, they had meetings. Yeah, they created programs or they had training sessions. But how many? How many people attended? What really happened in the day-to-day activities of the program or the policy? We need to know those things, because we can't simply say a miracle occurs between inputs and outcomes. That doesn't actually have any rigor to it, right? Going all the way back to rigor and thinking about, can we really say a program had effects? We need that black box of implementation to know that they did what they said they would do before we can say, ah, yes, this program is responsible for those outcomes. I'm going to go further on this You'll see it again in slide six. We are so easily led into assumptions. And those assumptions are really good for us to examine and step back from. And I would encourage that even in the logic model process. So let's say someone says, all right, we're going to do training sessions, and these training sessions are going to change the way that people think about education policy. Okay, great. What in the training session is actually going to address that? Don't just assume that training is going to change someone's mind. We need to find the particulars of that training session that, again, connect back to that outcome of changing people's minds. If all the training session contains is, let's say, recommendations for changes or data points, did it really engage the people in the room to think about what their approach is to educational policy? Did it examine their pre-existing beliefs? And if it didn't, how can we know that we've changed their minds? We can't simply assume that what we do is having an effect. We need to really examine those connections, because there's a lot of things going on in the real world that can change our minds, and it could have nothing to do with our program or policy. And this is where it gets kind of ugly with evaluation, because the world is a complicated place. And if we're doing something outside of experiments, we really need to be cautious about saying that a program or a policy caused an outcome. It's a contributor, perhaps. That's a good way to phrase it. This contributes to the change in attitudes or the change in behaviors if we're looking at intermediate outcomes, or even the change in conditions if we're looking at long-term outcomes. Because, however, we are mostly dealing in a world where evaluations cannot be truly controlled experiments, we have to be cautious and not interpret the data too broadly. Make sure we examine our assumptions and also keep our interpretations within the realm of what is actually reasonable to say. I do a lot of this discussion in my statistics course, where we talk about how correlation isn't causation. But boy, is it hard to challenge that in the real world. A lot of folks come in thinking, if two things move together, aka what I would call correlation, then obviously one is affecting the other. But I would encourage you to investigate that. Think about that, right? There's a great website that is basically all about these crazy high levels of correlations that don't actually have anything to do with causation. The website is actually called tylervigen.com, TYLERVIGEN.com, and he does spurious correlations, which is essentially saying, look, these two things move together so closely, they're so highly correlated, can we think about the fact that maybe correlation isn't causation? And the one that's come up today, popularity of the first name Marquis or Marquis, depending on how you pronounce it, and it correlates with robberies in the state of Kansas. The correlation rate is like 90%. Are people named Marquis or Marquis robbing everyone in Kansas? Absolutely not. It's just a simple way of showing that data can move together without causing anything. So don't mistake that fact. It's great to talk about how things might be correlated to one another, they might be contributing to one another, but it's really important not to say there's something causing something else if we don't have really solid evidence of that. The example I use in class, ice cream consumption and shark attacks. As ice cream consumption goes up, shark attacks do too. So clearly, our eating of vanilla or chocolate or Twist or Rocky Road or rum raisin or, you know, butter pecan, whatever flavor you love, well, it makes us more appetizing for sharks. Literally no one in that room would look at me and think I was of sound mind if I made that kind of argument, because they're all thinking to themselves, hey, did you miss the fact that summer affects both of these things as well? We have to keep all of that in mind when we're looking at any program or policy to avoid sounding like idiot Jenny walking into a room saying, hey, let's decrease shark or ice cream sales and that'll cut our shark attack rate. Nobody, again, is going to take that seriously. And by gosh, I certainly hope that they don't. A few other points to highlight from Chapter 11, two key terms, and these are relevant for our final exam. What is overinterpretation versus what is misinterpretation? I want you to know the difference, and I'm not going to lay it right out here on this podcast. Go back, reread those definitions and anything related to the two, and then let me know what questions you have. And then there are different ways, of course, of sharing data and information from an evaluation, different reporting methods. That's going to be listed in 11.4.3 as far as sections of the book. There are different contents you can include in reports, 11.4.4. It's important to kind of evaluate and look at those for yourself and think about what would be most useful for you. Let's say you're doing an evaluation in your professional field. What would people most want to see? Or what information would be most useful for individuals who, like you, work in your topic area and maybe want to know more about what is working and what isn't working or what has been done in the past and what effects that has? A side point here, but one that I really want to make sure to, you know, probably overemphasize is the criticality, like the true necessity of good communication. So communication for any evaluation is important. You need to try and be on the same page as the folks you're evaluating, you know, to the extent that you can be. You can disagree over different data points as far as like, well, I think it means this, they may think it means something else. As long as both interpretations aren't like a misinterpretation, then we should be okay, you know, to have differences of opinion. But communication when it comes to reporting out is a little more challenging. So I've written, like I've said, a fair number of evaluation reports, dozens over the course of my career. And for the most part, what I've gotten back is pretty good feedback about, I understand this, or this seems to make sense. But really the best feedback I get is someone having to help clarify something that I might have found and put into a report. Perhaps I found that we're seeing fewer numbers of individuals that are, you know, potential participants in a program. And someone can say to me, oh, well, this other program just launched at this time and is really, you know, actively engaging that group. So that might be why we're seeing fewer people. Well, that's a great thing to know and to be able to take account of. Make sure when you're preparing something like a presentation, like a formal report, or maybe even an infographic, have your stakeholders, whoever is really invested and involved in the evaluation, look it over and give you feedback. It's going to sound a little counterintuitive on some level because you might not want to share things early, especially if it's negative feedback. But I find that that is really a valuable opportunity that for most people is, again, not something they would want to do. So I'm going to take a really strong stance. I always recommend having someone else look over any evaluation product you create and give you feedback on it. Try to go to stakeholders that are going to actually read it and pay attention, interpret it, you know, ingest the information, so to speak, and not simply be turning it away if they don't agree with what you've found. That's a little hard to do. And usually it's helpful if you have an evaluation team or more than one of you doing an evaluation. But quite simply, at least if you incorporate some of the stakeholders, you know ahead of time what the follow-up meetings are going to be like. There have been moments where I have shared my results and fully known going into a future meeting, it's going to be a bit of a battle to talk about whatever I have measured or evaluated. In fact, it can kind of get ugly. It just depends. Sometimes these are very charged topics. Whenever I worked on juvenile justice in Douglas County, there wasn't really a room that I went into that didn't, you know, have the opportunity or potential to turn into a bit of a powder keg conversation, because people were very invested in figuring out how to improve the juvenile justice system. And quite a few people at the table had personal involvement, either in their own history, with their family members, or maybe they were running a program that was actually funded and potentially looking at funding losses because of something in my evaluation report. It's still good to know ahead of time what folks are going to be likely to say, or how the conversation might be set up if you put an evaluation report out there in front of all of them. If they've seen it before, you can't be quite as blindsided than when they haven't. And boy, those blindside conversations, very, very difficult. So what you can do to prevent them, or to at least give yourself the heads up on them, I think is a good strategy. All right, we are into our final chapter on informing and using an evaluation. And I kind of touched upon that a little bit with that last conversation about communication, but slide 10 is one of my favorite things because it is the evaluation no-no, as in you don't want to be the evaluator who is like in this Dilbert cartoon who says, you know, I did all of this work and nobody's really listening, right? It's obviously an exaggeration, but he gets to saying, you know, these tests are meaningless, misleading. Here's the gap between the results and reality. And someone says, we'll use the test results anyway, because it's the only data we have. Okay. That is the ultimate in conversation where you are just, as an evaluator, truly questioning the why. Or maybe in your heads, as in mine, you're thinking to yourself, WTF. That, not a great place to be, again. So I'm going to say this, chapter 12, because it's about sharing evaluations, because it's about informing, I think it's a really good read. I think you need to read it thoroughly. It's not going to blow your mind. It's not going to make you rethink everything. It's more about returning to that first part of an evaluation where we're thinking about who is involved and how we can get them to use the results of an evaluation in an effective way. If we want an evaluation to be used, if we want things like accountability for successes and failures, or if we want to make and support changes that lead to the outcomes that people are seeking, it's actually not going to be us who does all of that. It's going to be the people doing the work and whether they understand what an evaluation says, and then, you know, applying that so that they can become part of the future progression of the program. Or in the worst case scenario, they have to wind things down. You're literally looking at the termination of a program. With people who are using an evaluation, it is really critical for you to think about your audience. This is nothing, again, that is mind-bendingly, you know, insightful. But I think people tend to approach evaluation almost as an academic exercise, where I'm just going to put the information out there and they can choose to use it or not. That is probably going to put your evaluation work in peril of not being used. Because again, we need to think about who it is and how they can use it. So the first thing you need to think about with your audience is, who are you talking to? Is this the people in charge of the program? Are these the staff members who are doing the day-to-day work? Is this audience the people who are receiving the services? And what does it mean to have this information in front of each of them? The leadership might be really in tune with learning about both successes and failures of the program. But if you attempt on some level to really address significant failures on the behalf of the staff, that's probably not going to be a very fun conversation, largely because they're going to interpret that as a potential threat. You're telling them that they're not doing their job well, or at least that's what they're going to hear. And it doesn't actually mean that's what you've said, but most people do tend to internalize it in that way. So how can you phrase it? How can you discuss it in ways that amp down that emotional response so that people are thinking more about the results? Part two of getting people to use an evaluation, and this is going to be something you need to think of earlier on rather than later. It can't be like chapter 12 right at the end of the evaluation process. How and when have people been involved in the evaluation throughout the entire thing? If they're involved in the process, in the development of a report, or in the development of anything that you're publishing about a program, they're generally more on board, right? They will be more likely to use the information. They're often more collaborative in the evaluation process, which makes your job easier. And when they get that final product, it's far more likely they're actually going to use it to make changes. So if you are an external evaluator and you're being told to be very hands-off, you still need to build relationships. And you still need to, I think, find ways to incorporate, program or policy staff in the process of building whatever evaluation products you create. Okay, point three about this. If you're looking at people using evaluation, what are their constraints or what are their limits? So maybe people who are staff really want to make a change and they're basing that on your evaluation report. But whoever's in charge is saying that that's not an option. Maybe it's too expensive. Maybe it's an impossibility given the political dynamics of a situation. You have to keep that in mind. And as an evaluator, you need to see that big picture probably more so than anyone else. You need to be able to step back and take that in and understand it and definitely be easy in the judgment phase of being an evaluator. We are human beings. We do have, you know, vested interests, at least in people hopefully using our work, our evaluation report or presentation or whatever we come up with. It's pretty hard to have someone look at months worth of work and say, yeah, we're not interested. We're not going to use this. It's irrelevant, right? Leads me to the Dilbert cartoon. Very much how you end up feeling, like, what a waste. But keep in mind, there are going to be limits on what can be done in an actual evaluation setting. And the people who are available to make the changes may choose not to, and the people who want to make the changes may not have the power to. Okay, all of these things, good contextual factors to, you know, don't lose sight of. And then last but not least, what are the politics of any issue or situation? I am a political scientist by training. I can tell you that at no point in time in any job that I've ever had is there no politics. I mean, unless you consider working as a private consultant who doesn't have any bosses or any coworkers to report to. That doesn't mean politics isn't part of my life, because I still have to think about, who am I contracting with? Who am I doing this evaluation for? And what are they going to be anticipating that they need to see to keep them, let's say, in good graces with the right people? That's a political situation. If you are doing an evaluation that is inherently very charged, and again, I'll use my example of juvenile justice in Omaha, Nebraska, that is potentially going to land your evaluation in no man's land. Not because of you or any of the quality of the work that you've done, but because it is so politically charged. it is out of your control. It's probably out of the control of several others. It may be such a dynamic thing that we just really can't do much to take action on the evaluation, which, let's be honest, that sucks. You've done a lot of work. You've done a lot of great research. You've asked good questions. You've developed relationships with the staff. You've done everything in your power to do a good job. And sometimes that's where it ends. You've done the good job, and the report is out there for someone to read down the road in 15 years. And at that point, maybe they can come to the changes that need to happen. I truly do have a lot of personal experience in this realm. In that juvenile justice evaluation, the funders decided to shift their path. The funders of the evaluation, that is. And so they decided to contract with an external evaluator from another state without any real reasoning as to why they made that change. And that seemed to be largely about the politics of the time. At least I could see that once I was several months, you know, out of that situation. It's really important to keep the politics in mind. Just to also know, you know, where you might be stepping on a landmine, so to speak. And with that, I'm going to get to my last real substantive slide on these topics. There are a lot of things that make evaluation a great job. You are involved, hopefully, in something you care about. You're able to really dig in and answer questions, maybe get amazing data that other people have never had the chance to get their hands on, and to share things with people who care, who might be able to really, really revolutionize the path of some process, be it conservation, foster care, food deserts, whatever you find yourself drawn to. And then at other times, it is quite simply a slog, like any job where you've got to get up and remind yourself, okay, this is how I'm going to pay the bills. And you're going to run into people who don't like you, who don't support you, who feel threatened by you, who may be on the opposite side of the evaluation, who might straight up say things to your face that are downright offensive. I remember the first meeting I was in related to juvenile justice where someone flat out called me racist and biased. And I didn't see any connection because all I was sharing were data points, right? So it wasn't that I was overtly saying something that was racist or biased, but the interpretation in that context was that somehow my data points were my position on something or me saying something that I wasn't actually saying. And in those moments, you need to breathe. Some of what you are dealing with is people facing information that, again, is hard for them to hear. So you've got to kind of be a coach. And you've got to coach them through it. Whether it's positive or negative, we're usually going to learn from failures and painful incidences, probably a bit more than the real great successes. I can't speak for everyone, but I can say in being an educator for, you know, 20 plus years, I've seen a lot more learning from failure. And those aren't always the best conversations, but it is important to envision yourself more in that coaching role where we're going to have to work through this and you're going to have to coach individuals through some level of change, right? Because an evaluation is not intended to simply be a stamp of approval. If it was, I don't know why we would spend all this time and effort on it. Just give it the damn stamp, so to speak. We need to think in that, from that lens, that is. And being a coach is not often fun. I've been there and done that too. There's a lot of scenarios in coaching I wouldn't want to go back to. But if you can do things like listen to people, and I mean truly listen, not just have them talk at you while you're tuning them out and engaging in something else, which is something we all do at some point in time. If you can actually build trust for, like, you know, any number of topics or in any kind of settings, it doesn't have to be like you trust someone with their with your children or something like that, but trust to have honest conversations, that's really important. And then having constructive interactions, not simply tearing one another down, but finding positives to build on, or thinking about ways to frame a conversation with someone so they do hear you. Some people approach this as, you know, the compliment sandwich, where you say something good and then you go to something that people maybe need to work on or is not as positive, and then you finish with a compliment. Well, that might be appropriate, I guess, but that depends on who you're talking to. So don't lose that lens of, again, who am I speaking with? What is my audience? And what do we need to do to really make this work in terms of hopefully using an evaluation and allowing it to support the change that needs to happen? Okay, that is it. That is all. I have rambled for 35 minutes. You are done with the material at this point in time. I do hope you've gained a fair amount of knowledge on evaluation, as well as some level of just this in the real world isn't that crazy or complex, but we do need to have a structured approach to it, right? I don't care if you're going with a goal-free evaluation or an objectives-oriented evaluation. I don't care if you're doing quantitative or qualitative. I don't care if you really like to do observation or you want to do experimentation. Whatever you choose, good evaluation is planned and put into action, you know, following that plan with space for adjustment. It's like a program or a policy. Approach evaluation the same way. Be open to change, and yet be also willing to have structure to it. Because if you do it on the fly, people don't tend to see it as evaluation. It's just judgment at that point in time. So turning to the final project, I want to reiterate for I don't know how many times, but just you're just creating a plan, right? So all I'm asking you to do in this project, put together how you would do an evaluation. Don't carry out the evaluation. You are not expected to find real data on the program to answer the evaluation questions. You're just writing the questions, and then you're saying, okay, if this is my question, how would I answer it? What information would I need? AKA, what indicators or measures would I need? What sources would have that information? Would I find that in records? Would I need to do interviews, you know, with participants? And then what was your data collection technique for that information? So if I need to talk to participants, I'm going to do interviews. Or I might gather information from participants using surveys. If the data I need is in existing records, all I need to say is, like, I'm reviewing records. That evaluation matrix is not going to be maybe as highly technical and complex as it seems initially. So take a step back, think more simply about it, and remember, it's a proposal. It's not a plan that you're going to put into action these last few weeks of class. On the final exam, the only point I want to make there is that the format is the same as the midterm. So you have the same number of days, the same number of questions you need to respond to, the same number of sections that will be there. So you'll choose one question from each section to answer. You'll have about 5 days to respond. Please, if you haven't already, go look at the feedback on the midterm exams and then let me know what questions you have about the upcoming final. And know that, yep, we are barreling towards it very soon. So if you need to reach me, please do so as soon as possible. Email me at jemille@wsc.edu. Thank you all for taking the time to take this course, for listening to these podcasts. If you've made it this far into the episode, I know it's a longer one. Please do, if you can, fill out the course eval link on Canvas. Should be on the left-hand menu under course eval. I do take all the feedback seriously. This is my form of evaluation, right? And I use multiple points like that mid-course evaluation, as well as the summative end-of-semester evaluation, where you can say, all right, we're in the last weeks. Here's what I really think. I'm not as keen on the questions on the course evals as if I would design them myself, because I'd probably ask you way more questions with way more detail, but let's be reasonable here. We don't need so many surveys overwhelming us. So, Okay. That's all for me. I really do appreciate all of your work. Take care. Have a great rest of your day and week and month and year. And I do hope to connect with you again soon.